Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, folks, thanks for coming along tonight. Patrick Morgan makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here previously when he spoke about his collection of Bob Santamaria's correspondence, which was published by Melbourne University Press. Then subsequently, Patrick edited a book of Bob Santamaria's documents. But he's here tonight on the occasion of the release of his most recent book, Melbourne Before Mannix, Catholics in Public Life, 1880 to 1920, which has just been released by Connor Court. And we've called the topic for tonight's talk, Melbourne Before Archbishop Daniel Mannix, in case people on our website didn't know who Mannix was. But I guess everyone here does. They also know Patrick well, so I'll introduce him very briefly. Patrick Morgan has written a number of books on topics where the literature, history and politics intersect. And as I mentioned, he's edited two volumes of the writings of B.A. Santamaria. He's a frequent contributor to Quadrant and other journals. He's been an academic. He's held positions on various arts bodies. But he's here today as the author of Melbourne Before Mannix. Patrick, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jared, to talk on a Melbourne topic here. My book commemorates the centenary this month of Dr. Mannix's appointment as coadjutor Archbishop of Melbourne. But because it's a history book, Melbourne Before Mannix partly, I'll talk on an earlier coadjutor appointment. In 1868, the Irish Catholic Henry O'Farrell, you've probably heard of this, shot the visiting Duke of Edinburgh in Sydney, an event which caused immense anti-Catholic and anti-Irish feeling. What's less well known is that in 1882, O'Farrell's crazed brother shot the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne, Gould, in a street in Melbourne. Now, like the Prince, Gould survived. The thing that the O'Farrell brothers had in common was not they were Fenians, as Henry Parkes said, but they were very bad shots. They were bad men. Both the assassination victims survived. But Gould declined and died from this 6 years later. It was during his decline that Cardinal Moran arrived in Sydney, who wanted to run the whole Australian church, and he prodded the Vatican to get the declining Gould to appoint a coadjutor bishop. Gould, prickly about his independence and remembering his long decades of pioneering work in the Australian mission, when appointed Bishop of Port Phillip in 1846, he rode a horse from Sydney to Melbourne to take up his appointment. He replied to Rome in, I think, this wonderful letter, "Thank God I have no need of a coadjutor. When the time comes, I will request this great favour from the Holy See with all due submission." He had no intention of doing this, and he never did. "As I am the senior bishop in Australia and one of the first missionaries of the colony, I hope the correspondence of propaganda in the affairs of this province of Victoria will be sent to me directly, not through Monsignor Moran of Sydney." Gould was not going to be trumped by a newly arrived cardinal. This was an opening shot in the long rivalry between the Melbourne and Catholic, Melbourne-Sydney Catholic sees. In this book, I'm sad to say to you, the Victorian Catholic Church comes out favourably in comparison with its New South Wales counterpart, but a Sydney person, Patrick O'Farrell, said the same. But with the Labour Party, it's the reverse. The New South Wales ALP branch was successful and favourable to Catholics. And in Victoria, there's just been a history of it written, the Victorian branch called Neither Power Nor Glory. It was a hopelessly unsuccessful branch, and it was also unfavourable to Catholics. I'm not saying these two things necessarily go together. My book is about Catholic life in the decades under Carr, for 30 years, and then at the first 7 years of Mannix's reign in Melbourne. Now, Mannix's many biographers, trying to explain his turbulent 50 years in Australia, naturally turned to his earlier 50 years in Ireland to explain his activities here. But I think there's pretty slim pickings, because Mannix lived his whole adult life in a semi-enclosed seminary, Maynooth, and he said here in Australia that he was never involved in a public controversy in the whole of his time in Ireland. My basic idea, therefore, for this book was that understanding the decades in Melbourne Catholic life before he arrived is the more important prehistory of Mannix's activities in Australia. Then we can ask, which I do in this book, what he inherited from the Melbourne Archdiocese, how he fitted in, and most importantly, what he changed. There's a bit of confusion. The book was launched last night. I've called the book Mannix Before Melbourne because it's a lovely alliterative title, but of course the last third is the first 7 years. I couldn't call it Melbourne Before Mannix and a bit after, but this is, of course, my focus was to explain Mannix. But at the launch last night, we had a seminar on it. No one talked about Mannix, everyone talked about Carr, how he'd been neglected, Mannix had been overdone, what a wonderful person Carr was, etc., etc. So, because of this confusion, I should explain, there are the first two-thirds of the book is about Melbourne, largely lay Catholics, and their activity under Carr. The last third is about, and that's very impressive, the last third is about Mannix, who's oppressive in a different way, and I'm using the two to connect them. One of the main connections is the wonderful Melbourne lay elite actually fell out, or disagreed with Mannix, and largely fell out with him. That's a large part of the story. So though I had my eye on Mannix, I discovered the Carr period was an impressive story in its own right. Under Carr, a great flourishing of religious activity took place. Melbourne came to lead the Catholic Church in many ways. This was largely because Carr encouraged lay initiative, and like Cardinal Moran here, who wanted to do it all himself. When the large Catholic lay organisation, the Australian Catholic Federation, eventually 60,000 members, was founded in 1911, Moran wouldn't allow it in Sydney. It began here only after his death. Melbourne's three Catholic papers were the outlets of a dozen or so Melbourne lay Catholics, there are a number of priests, but who were the movers and shakers of their time. All were thinkers, writers and organisers who formed new Catholic institutions, which were so successful they spread to a nationwide, they became nationwide institutions such as the Hibernians, the Catholic Young Men's Society, the Australian Catholic Truth Society, the Australian Catholic Federation, the Newman Societies and the monthly magazine Austral Light. While writing this book, I came to realise that the lineaments of the Catholic Melbourne I knew after the Second World War had been established not by Archbishop Mannix, but by his lesser-known predecessor, Archbishop Carr. I'll briefly mention two Melbourne lay Catholics who made a brief splash on the world stage. The first one is James Hogan. He wrote the first history of the art called The Irish in Australia, a Melbourne journalist. A fellow journalist in the 1880s called Alfred Deakin said of him, "He is an able and industrious journalist, never without a book and always likely to be run over by a tram." He got himself elected as an Irish Member of Parliament, and he spoke in the great Home Rule debate with Gladstone in the audience. And he said, I'm giving my own, that the great theme of his book, The Irish in Australia, and when he gave a speech in the Parliament in the Home Rule Bill, was the following. The British government gave Victoria, after 19 years after Europeans got there, they're only Aboriginal for 19 years. It was founded in 1835. In 1854, we got self-rule, home rule, self-government. Whereas a distinguished nation like Ireland, which had been a famous nation for at least 1,500 years, was denied it. An even more remarkable Victorian Catholic was Arthur Lynch. Arthur Lynch is from Ballarat. Arthur Lynch's father was a Eureka rebel. Arthur Lynch was a journalist too, also a member of Westminster. He was reporting for the British press on the Boer War, and like many home rulers, he supported the Boers because they saw a great parallel here. The British were treating the Boers very badly, like they were treating the Irish, and the Boers had to have a military campaign to beat the British, and the Irish saw they were going to have to do the same. And he persuaded President Kruger to appoint him head of the Irish Brigade, fighting for the Boers. He was promoted to colonel, he had no military experience, and he led an Irish brigade with mixed success for about 9 months in the Boer War. After the war finished, he went to Ireland and got himself elected as a member for Galway. Rumours started to spread around about his activities, and as he arrived at Westminster, he was arrested, charged with treason, and sentenced to death. This was a member of the British Parliament, sentenced to death. There was an enormous outcry. He was in solitary confinement for a year. He was commuted to life imprisonment. While campaigning in America for the Boers and Home Rule, he'd got to know President Teddy Roosevelt, who made representations to the British government, and after 6 years in jail, he was released and resumed for 10 years in the British Parliament. If I've got time, talk on one remarkable local Catholic called Dr. Kenny, rigged out here. The surgeon, Dr. Kenny, served the male Melbourne Archdiocese as a prominent layman for 6 decades. The first of his 3 papal knighthoods, he's dressed up here as a papal knight. I said in the book, splendidly robed. I think he looks a bit of a dork in this outfit, if you can see it there. He got the first of his 3 papal knighthoods at the extraordinarily young age of 23. The fact that he was the Archbishop Carr's cousin had something to do with it. As the Melbourne press pointed out, he eventually got 3 gongs. Nepotism was ripe. Cardinal Moran was the nephew of the leading Cardinal Cullen. When Archbishop Mannix got to Melbourne, he appointed his cousin Father Foley, Bishop of Ballarat. Kenny's last public appearance, he started off in 1885 helping his cousin, was at the age of 86 to chair a giant Catholic meeting at the exhibition building, 60,000 there, on the coming World War, at which Prime Minister Menzies and Mannix spoke. This was the first public appearance of the 24-year-old Bob Santa Maria, the organiser of the meeting, who gave his first public speech there. Santa Maria's relation to Mannix is the same as Kenny's to Carr, a younger friend and confidant of the Archbishop who carries out major organisational and propaganda tasks for the Archdiocese. The Melbourne Irish. 19th century Melbourne was like Sydney and Brisbane, almost a quarter Irish Catholic. For a number of reasons, Melbourne became the focal point of consciousness of being Irish Australian and of consciousness of the wrongs of old Ireland. The reasons are the following. The publisher and owner of The Advocate, Joseph Winter, was a relentless propagandist for Home Rule for 4 decades and was treasurer of every Home Rule organisation for 35 years, and he personally raised £40,000 for the cause. I know the Sydney had Tighe Ryan doing the same with the Catholic press later on, but Winter did it for about 40 years. Also in Melbourne was the leading Gaelic scholar Nicholas O'Donnell, the one who wrote all the articles on it, and the organiser Morgan Jagers. These three were chairman, treasurer and secretary of all Home Rule organisations for 35 years. Another reason for Irish interest in Melbourne was the Christian Brothers domain. And like Sydney, you had the less aggressive Marist Brothers, who were originally a French order. The Christian Brothers had anti-British nationalism in their DNA because they were founded during the penal days, you probably know, of hedge schools. And that was their feeling. I went to the Christian Brothers in the 40s and 50s, and they were reasonably explicitly anti-British, even at that stage. Menzies, I remember, Churchill resigned as Prime Minister. The Melbourne Age quivered with vice-regal fervour, saying he was the greatest Englishman who ever lived. Our brother Regan just said he let us down in 2 World Wars and went on with the lessons. Victoria had in addition 3 early Irish Catholic premiers. This is Sir John O'Shaughnessy 3 or 4 years after Home Rule. Then Sir Charles Gavan Duffy in the 60s, a young Ireland rebel, like your Sir John Robinson, opened up the land for selection. And Sir Brian O'Loughlin. Irish Home Rule delegates sent out to Australia said Melbourne, like Boston, was well known in Ireland as an organised and fervent supporter. I mean, they may have been flattering us and said it in Sydney too. That's what they're reported as saying. So Mannix's arrival in Australia is not entirely random in time and place. He came to the city in Australia most conscious of its Irish heritage, and in time he came just before the Easter Rebellion, when Irish events began for the first time to play a role in Australian affairs. But there's a very big catch. There's always a catch. Melbourne's Irish propagandists were much more moderate on Irish issues than their American counterpart and Mannix for a number of reasons. Coming a generation after the famine, those who came to Australia were working in lower middle class rather than the utterly destitute, the starving of a previous generation, the famine generation. And so our memories, the Australian Irish memories of Ireland, were as a consequence less bitter than those who left a generation earlier for America. The long voyage out meant a permanent psychological as well as physical break from Ireland, with little chance of returning and less emotional investment in the affairs of the old world, including Ireland. Thirdly, the Irish lived here under British rule, and so were less likely to develop an anti-British worldview, and if they did, they were less likely to express it than those in the independent United States. These factors combined to lead the Australian Irish to be more temperate, as Olive McDonough, the expert on this area, has pointed out, in their subsequent political affiliations, and much more moderate than Dr. Mannix, which was to cause problem for him and them subsequently in Melbourne. Sydney had a much more radical group, documented by O'Farrell, who were interned during the First World War. Another factor of Irish demographics is very important. The Irish who came to Australia were landless, single in both senses, unmarried, came out as individuals, not as group, rural, landless, unskilled, and without capital. But the other fact about them, which is very important in this story, is the Irish were the only group who brought out a large number of women, also unmarried, young adults. No other immigrant group did. They tended to bring families out. And this has a major effect. I was looking at these 15 guys, a couple of women, who were the leading lay people in Melbourne, and one day I wrote down their backgrounds, and I found out of the 15, only 5 were pure Irish Australians. Others were converts, some from mixed marriages, and some a parent had converted and then married. So there's a very big strain of English, New Zealand, Scottish and other religions in the Melbourne group. We tended to assume, I did when I grew up, that the coherent Irish Catholic group in Melbourne, evident from the 1880s to the 1950s, always existed. But in earlier decades, the overall population, including Catholics, was much more jumbled. People were much freer coming out on the goldfields, and in goldfield society especially, this was the case. During the 1850s, 50%, half of Irish women married out. Whereas, of course, by 1910, all the families I come from, it was 90-95% marrying in. It was virtually unheard of to marry out. So this meant that you had a much more mixed background. It was pretty typical of the melting pot atmosphere of Australia at the time. This gave the Catholic activist I was looking at later in the century an unexpected breath, influences their outlook, and throws into contention just what phrases like Irish Australian, Irish Catholic. These are monochrome terms which mask a much more diverse background, a much more interesting background, including the important strain of English Catholicism. It was only later in the century, I found out, about the 1890s, where people were moving into the cities, where there was a more critical mass, there was a greater marriage group. Sectarianism got much worse, so the Irish huddled together to deflect the flames of sectarian scorn against them. The church was moving against mixed marriages. There was more Irish immigration pouring into Melbourne. For all these reasons, Catholics then started to marry in, and they caused that very large group we called Irish Australians. But it wasn't there. So the tribalisation of Catholics, you expect normally when an immigrant group comes, they huddle together and they gradually assimilate. The Catholics in Melbourne mixed much more freely between 1840 and 1880. It was in a later period that they huddled together, and their marriage, the intermarriage of Catholic to Catholic, is very high. Now we get to the other point is that of the converts, and there are many, loyalty to Catholicism is only one of their moves, and and sometimes not their prime loyalty, because when the Boer War comes and the First World War comes, it's the Catholics of English background, sometimes remote English background, of course, who are the ones who back the British establishment and fall out, in some cases very severely, with Mannix. Benjamin Hall was a convert, a leader writer for the age. The great, like all converts, enormously, more Catholic than the Catholic. He was the great arguer for Catholics for 20 or 30 years, a great propagandist because he was a journalist. He spent a lot of time arguing that Catholics, against what everyone said, people said there are more Catholics in jail than more Catholic drunks, more Irish Catholics in jail than more Irish Catholics, more Irish Catholic drunks than other groups. He tried to prove statistics for years that this was wrong. No Irish Catholic would ever have tried to prove that. Now the arrival of Dr. Mannix, who arrives in 1913. Soon after his arrival, he becomes a controversial figure. But what's tumultuous is not his coming, but world events at the time. Coinciding with his arrival, the very settled, predictable and relatively simple pattern you can describe under Carr is shattered by world events. The years from 1914 to 1924 caused seismic shifts in the position of the main actors in Melbourne. A series of cascading, interwoven eruptions, as you know, takes place. The outbreak of the First World War. In the same week, Home Rule passes but is postponed for the duration of the war. Next week, the Pope dies and the new Pope tries to negotiate between the forces in the First World War, and that changes Catholic attitudes. Then you have the Easter Rising. Every 18 months you have another conscription referenda, the Anglo-Irish War, and then the Irish Civil War. These events took everyone, including Mannix, out of their previous comfort zones, coping with world affairs. But looking at Mannix, he had to make many more simultaneous adjustments at the time. Moving from Ireland to Australia is a very big move of his. He has to adjust to Australian politics, which he didn't understand, and he had to adjust to Melbourne's style of Catholicism, which he understood but didn't agree with. Moreover, he had to move from private to public life, which in my opinion is his biggest move, because as he said, he'd never been in a public controversy before. Whether this move into public life went against a natural inclination to privacy or suited a previously undisclosed political acumen, he never revealed. I think the latter is more likely, that he had an instinctive feel for politics, but both may be true. In his later career, he's a very detached private man. He never visited government house like Carr loved doing. He never went to dinner parties. He never entertained at home. He was an isolated aristocrat, a tribal chieftain with great hauteur, great detachment, and also a very private man who never revealed basically the wellsprings of his thought. Most Mannix biographers naturally, when they get him to Australia, place him in a political context with the advent of the 1916 Easter Rising and the conscription referendum. This makes him look very dominant. He was soon equal and opposite of a prime minister. But his primary location was in the Catholic Church. Viewed from this perspective, he looks a less assured, though still an outstanding figure, one who was feeling his way. He was, to use our modern cliche, on a steep learning curve. And in his early times in Australia, he made a number of bad tactical and political mistakes. If I don't get onto them later, I've published in the current quadrant an account which documents some of these mistakes. Changing Melbourne Catholicism. Now, I have an illustration for this rather complex topic which I've put here. There's this wonderful photo called a Melbourne Indignation Meeting in 1906, which visually illustrates the point I'm going to make. I think people have got a copy there. I've put it up. If you've seen it in your papers, if you have a look at that. The characteristics of Melbourne Catholicism when Mannix arrived was, like all repressed minorities, it lived in a world of internal self-congratulation and external defiance, basically, and Mannix broke this down. Here are Melbourne Catholics, they're having an indignation meeting. It's just before a second federal election, and so a few Protestant bigots have attacked the church in the usual way. And so they all get into Cathedral Hall, a thousand of them there in their Sunday best, and they're going to feel indignant for 2 hours after this meeting. I've read the account of it. And they get up, and for 2 hours they say, we've been badly done by, and they wallow in the fact internally that the others are having a go at them. Now, I mean, you can be sympathetic to them, but this is really, in political terms, it doesn't move you forward, to use the today's phrase. They're just sitting there, feeling sorry for themselves for 2 hours. No one knows this is happening. They're not in the Argus or the Age out. They're doing it to themselves. This is the sort of thing Mannix broke down. He didn't in his early years as Archbishop ponder on such questions as salvation outside the church or mixed marriages or abortion or other staples of the sermons of the Catholic morals. Not so a word on any of these in his first decade in Australia. He didn't spend his time debating Protestant clergymen on the long-standing disputes caused by the Reformation. He didn't emphasise at all the 19th century devotional practices of Jansenist piety and personal moral guilt. I don't have to explain the crippling effect of this, because every autobiography of a Catholic childhood has done that for you. Mannix helped Melbourne Catholics in a very short time to face modernity. Carr's attitude was the last stage of the Counter-Reformation view that the whole world could be brought back into the Catholic fold. Mannix knew that wasn't on the cards. And he helped Melbourne Catholics to break from being morally hamstrung by these Jansenist nostrums. This had some surprising consequences. It was ironically an archbishop who to some extent broke the hold of the clergy had on laymen and women. Up to this stage, Catholic bishops had been in the business of finger-wagging admonition. They were very good at admonishing people. They admonished their own flocks for their moral failings, and they loved admonishing their Protestant opponents for not appreciating the benefits of Catholic belief. However, Mannix faced the other way. He didn't speak at his flock at all. Instead, he faced the other way. He identified with his people, speaking on their behalf to the public, in what we call the public realm, not having little indignation meetings at all among themselves, and this made them warm to him. He encouraged them, his flock, and brought them on, as he had done with his seminary students in Ireland. He wasn't so much church-centred as society-centred. Mannix realised that Catholics were now living in a largely secular world. He adapted to this and was able to act outside the church realm on behalf of his congregation. But to do this is an important point, he had to form a new alliance over the heads of the Catholic elite and clergy, a very admirable group, as I've tried to say before. He formed a new alliance between himself and ordinary Melbourne Catholics who applauded his speeches. The most prominent Catholic layman, Dr. Kenny, differed with Mannix on conscription in Ireland. The Celtic Club, the United Irish League, the Home Rule Body, and the Gaelic League all had ructions over conscription, over Irish nationalism, and particularly over, they were all Redmanite constitutionalists, that is, they believed the British government would freely offer Ireland Home Rule. Mannix didn't believe that, and there was a big squabble over that, of course. Morgan Jagers, head of the Home Rule Body, wrote to the High Court Justice Henry Vaughan Higgins. These people are both strong Home Rulers. He wrote of the sinister and powerful influence of Dr. Mannix, and he is Melbourne's leading Home Ruler. Morgan Jagers at this stage is being arraigned under the Wartime Precautions Act because he said publicly, I don't agree with the Sinn Feiners, but I think their case should be allowed to be said publicly. For that, they were trying to charge him. So a person of that kind was actually saying privately he was worried about the sinister influence of Dr. Mannix. Tom Brennan, editor of the leading Catholic paper, The Advocate, supported for conscription in the first referendum. The convert, Benjamin Hoare, was an outright opponent. And Benjamin Hoare walked up Bourke Street with all the leading British establishment people to meet Billy Hughes and ask that Mannix, the petition that Mannix should be silenced or deported or ostracised or whatever. The Speaker of the Victorian Parliament, a Catholic, or a former Catholic, Sir Frank Madden, asked that Mannix should be shot. Sir Frank Madden was, from his brother was the Chief Justice of Victoria, Sir John Madden, a Cork family.
He dropped Catholicism, and he dropped his Irish heritage. The Irish, we say that he was non-practicing Catholic. The Irish have a very nice way of saying this. They say he was baptised, but it didn't take. I think that's much less judgmental. Anyway, he asked that Mannix be shot, and for that he lost his seat at the next election, fortunately. Previously, the emphasis of historians has been on the intense public squabbles Mannix, leading a Catholic phalanx, had with the Prime Minister Billy Hughes and the conscriptionist. But there were just as many squabbles inside the Catholic community. So the picture of Mannix leading a united Catholic flock needs to be modified. The leading clerical and lay figures in Melbourne, with very few exceptions, and they are Frank Brennan, later an Attorney General in the Scullin government, a doctor, New Zealand doctor in Melbourne called Dr. Baldwin. They supported the Sinn Féin position. And one leading priest, Father Malone, a poet, supported the Sinn Féin position. But of the other 20 or so people I'm looking at, generally, they all disagreed quite strongly with Mannix. Some lay figures complained to Rome through the apostolic delegate about Mannix's activity. I think in Sydney it was the your Lord Mayor Sir Thomas Hughes, a grandfather of late Robert Hughes, and another one was Justice Hayden, who I think may be an ancestor of the recently retired Justice Hayden, but I'm not an expert on Sydney families. Mannix received 2 papal reprimands because of these complaints. Billy Hughes made similar representations to the British government in London, and in later life, Mannix's favourite anecdote related to these attempts of Billy Hughes to have him restrained by the British government. And the story Mannix liked to tell, I'll tell it in my own words, is the following. I've got it written down here. During the First World War, at a garden party at Buckingham Palace, the leading English statesman Asquith bumped into the leading Catholic prelate, Cardinal Gasquet. And Asquith said to Gasquet, "This fellow Mannix is giving us terrible trouble. How can you get him out of our hair?" And Gasquet, stalling for time and rather worried about this, said, "What do you want us to do with Mannix?" And Asquith said, "Well, just send him to Rome, put him in charge of a college or something." And Gasquet said, "Mannix to Rome? Heaven forbid. In Australia, we have him as far away as we can." Now, there's an interesting precedent to that story, because when your last Benedictine hierarch, Archbishop Vaughan of Sydney, died in 1883, the Melbourne Catholic paper The Advocate speculated that Archbishop Croke, the radical Irish nationalist, who, like Mannix, had been officially warned by the Vatican many years before, might be appointed to Sydney. The Melbourne Advocate said, "We can even imagine reason to why in certain quarters it might," this is 1883, "it might seem desirable that Croke should be sent out of Ireland and placed in Sydney. As it happens, there's a vacancy there in which he could be provided for at a long distance from Ireland." This didn't come about, but it's an eerie premonition of similar speculation that later arose, that Mannix, who followed the Croke line in Australia and also received papal warnings, that Mannix was being kept in exile in the Antipodes because of his nationalist sympathies. How's the time going?
About 3 or 4 minutes.
I'll leave out a couple of sections and just go on to the last one, which is the most difficult of all. This is the question of tribalisation versus assimilation. And I don't have the answer to this. I say in my book that Melbourne Catholics fluctuated between being tribalised and being assimilated over the decades. This is my rather cowardly way of saying I don't really know the answer to this question. I noticed 4 times in this period and later, Melbourne Catholics went back into their tribal situation and were seen as a quite separate group in the community. I'm not saying who causes, whether the people, the other Protestants were being sectarian or the Catholics were causing it, but the 4 occasions are the state aid in the 1870s onwards, home rule from the 1889 onwards becoming to its climax in the First World War, the 2 conscription referenda, and of course the DLP, Santa Maria, Labour split in the 1950s. In all these cases, you see Catholics seeming to huddle together as a tribal group, separate from the society. I'm not saying whose fault it is. And the main charge against Mannix has been he held up the natural assimilation of Irish Catholics into Australian society on two crucial occasions, in 1917 and the events of 1955, and that he reignited huge sectarian animosities which had previously died down. Now, I know there's some truth in that, but I want to give a number of arguments against it. In the same year as the second conscription referendum, Mannix opened in Melbourne Newman College and St Kevin's College. St Kevin's College was not a college, it was one room for ACBC. It was a one class where all Christian Brothers boys, it was a Christian Brothers domain, and others except the Jesuits, they ones who wanted to proceed on to leaving honours, get the matriculation, go to the university, go into the professions, go into the community, go into the public service. My uncle went there to get his Latin to go to become a priest. That was one way that Catholics would get on. And of course, the top of the icing was Newman College. You had St John's since 1860. Catholics didn't have a college. And in 1917-18, Mannix opened that. Now, people talk about a conscription referendum in that year hindering assimilation. In the long run, Newman College and St Kevin's College and the people they produced gradually lifted the Catholics in Melbourne, the Irish Catholics in Melbourne, into the professions, what we call upward social mobility. I think in the long run, that's a much bigger argument in favour of Catholics moving into the community than the temporary setback of conscription. The Labour Party split after the first conscription referendum. Many Protestants left because of their strong empire loyalties, and Catholics naturally stayed in, which meant Catholics had more numerical influence in the party. As I said, people said this caused Catholics to re-tribalise. But Professor Patrick O'Farrell draws the opposite conclusion. About this period, he says, the situation, second conscription referendum, had the curious effect of drawing Irish Catholics into the centre of Australian affairs in a way they'd never been before. Now, it was one aspect of the victorious anti-conscription movement. They had new friends with whom they could make common cause. I would say that's generally the left social, call the social left, the non-Catholic faction in the Labour Party. That's one group who they later fell out with in 1954. The nature of the anti-conscription movement also had the general effect of integrating Irish Catholics much more firmly into the Labour movement and, crucially, into the Labour Party. That's another argument against the anti-Mannix one. The final argument is, I think, that the word assimilation and tribalisation are not the right words. Irish Catholics didn't need to assimilate into Australian society. Australian society is British Isles society. It's Anglophone, Anglomorphic. Except there was no cultural gap when they came to Ireland, when they came to Australia. A Pole might have to assimilate into Australia in the 19th century. An Asian certainly would. And tragically, you know, the Aborigines may or may not wish to assimilate into our society. But assimilation is the wrong word. The real word is getting on in the society, getting a job, upward social mobility. And O'Farrell, I think, has got a knockdown argument on this, because he doesn't want to use those words of they're all being tribalised or they're not. And in his great book, The Irish in Australia, his general argument is that, contrary to the usual view that the Irish Catholic element in Australia was a force for disunity, that is, it was tribalised, O'Farrell argues generally that the Irish minority in Australia was so large and so influential, I mean, folk songs come from that, Australian humour comes from that, that the gradually forming Australian amalgam or consensus or mentality has the Irish Catholic element in it as an essential ingredient. The struggle of Irish Catholics for identity is a key element, he says, in the formation of the Australian consensus. Catholics, he says, Irish Catholics became part of the mainstream not by deferring to it, assimilation, nor by attacking it, moving back to their ghettos, but simply by confidently throwing their weight around and asserting themselves. They didn't have to assimilate to something else in Australian society, Protestant establishment. They actually created something else in Australia. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Patrick. We've got outside. Dan's got some copies of Melbourne Before Mannix, Catholics in Public Life, 1880 to 1920. So we come to question and discussion. We've got till no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. Patrick, you spoke about, if you just come back here and speak in the microphone as you were before, you spoke about Daniel Mannix's interaction with Melbourne Catholicism. What about his interaction with the Protestant ascendancy in Melbourne, which was to some extent from Northern Ireland, but also quite Protestant, beyond the Ulster impact? Because there is a view that Mannix felt that he was better treated in Ireland when he was at Maynooth by the officials at Dublin Castle in Dublin than he was when he came to Melbourne, where he found a degree of sectarianism in Melbourne that he hadn't really located in Dublin, because he was treated quite well as a bishop of the church. How did he get on with that group? Have you come across that in your work of his early years in Melbourne? Just speak into the microphone. Yeah.
I have a quotation here which just relates to this. This is Mannix talking when he first gets to Australia on this point. This is on sectarianism. He says, "For the greater part of my life I've been reading, and often it was unpleasant reading, the London Times and other journals, English and Irish, whose views differed much from mine. I was therefore long familiar with the type of journal which cannot rid itself, even if it tried, of bias and prejudice against the Catholic Church. But there was always, as I can now appreciate by contrast, an artistic restraint and reticence in the bigotry of those old world journals, like the London Times. If not out of respect for religion or for Catholicism, then as a concession to decency and to their own repute, they excluded from their columns the anti-religious press garbage which finds a ready market in Melbourne." Now, so he's really saying you have low-grade orange muscle flexing in Melbourne, low-grade garbage. He's really praising the London Times for being of a much higher quality than that. So he's saying in the British Isles context, he felt much more at home then. This is the identifiable Melbourne Mannix style, gentle ridicule and sarcasm. However, there's another aspect of this quotation. I noticed I hadn't put this in the book, but I've been reading this quotation. He's really saying, though, the Orange people aren't a threat. The Ulster people aren't a threat. They're so great. They're hopeless. The real threat is the London Times and the Melbourne establishment, the British Australian establishment, because they are, they're much more a danger, because they're much more subtle. Does that answer partly the question? His general style is to have a very, very subtle, he doesn't attack his opponents, he undermines them. And he has he actually does the same thing to his own Archbishop Carr. I can find the quote. He says, Carr's sitting there in the Cathedral Hall. He's actually on the stage with Mannix. And Mannix says in front of Carr, "Archbishop Carr's a man of peace and placidity, but he's been converted, not by me, laughter, not by you, but by those who for 25 years and more have denied him and denied you the barest justice, state aid. I myself am a sinner in this matter. The Archbishop said he gives advice when it's been sought. I fear I've broken his wise rule and give advice possibly when it was not sought." Now, this is very cheeky. He appears to be blaming himself, but like in the other quotation, he's really saying Carr's lost touch. New tactics are needed. Carr's nice and deferential and doesn't say anything unless he's asked. I'm going to get up and take the initiative in saying things. So he uses that style all the time. But there's just another little answer to that. I've just found out that there's another centenary this month. The Ulster Orange this month are celebrating the centenary of Carson's 1912 covenant to break away from the British Isle if Home Rule come. There's a Curragh mutiny, there's a military mutiny, and they wanted, like Smith in Rhodesia, to have declared a declaration of independence, a unilateral declaration of independence. They prepared that.
Isn't that treason?
Technically treason. The same people in Melbourne, Orangemen and the rest, who were engaged in supporting treason then, they're still doing it today, Alistair, were the people who accused Mannix of treason for exercising his constitutional right to vote against conscription in a referendum. That's pretty hard to take.
Now, Patrick, don't go away. Stay here. We don't want to lose you. There's a question here. We've got to be quick. Okay, we go down the back. Yep.
You made reference to Thomas Carr's church-centred mentality compared to Mannix's society-centred mentality. Would it be fair to say that Thomas Carr bequeathed a sectarianism, whereas unfortunately Mannix seems to have bequeathed the following generation a secularism, and that's what's happened to Melbourne Catholicism in the last generation?
Well, I try to take all that in. I think instinctively I don't agree with that. And Carr was not a sectarian. Carr got on very well with the establishment, basically. He played the very delicate, like Moran here, very delicate game of saying, I support home rule. He actually did, of course. He wasn't being a hypocrite. But he had to say that for his flock. I mean, they would have dropped him if he didn't. On the other hand, he said he supported home rule, but he didn't press it at all because he didn't want to get on offside with the Australian establishment. So he didn't flame sectarianism at all. He answered it, as I've shown in the book, whenever it came up. And like the Morley said, I'm just, people have attacked me, I'm being defensive, I'm only answering. The Protestants said the Carr's attacked. So, you know, it went on. But he wasn't at all encouraging sectarianism. Melbourne was notorious for sectarianism. The Anglican Archbishop Morehouse said it was the worst in the world, and the historian Geoffrey Searle, in his book on the period said Melbourne was appalling in sectarian terms from 1880 onwards. It's just unbelievable. So sectarianism is very high, but Carr is a very attractive, placid, amiable man who gets on with everyone. Last night at our launch, they were all saying how wonderful he was compared with Mannix because he was so genial and amiable and wonderful. So that's not true that he was there. Now, then you said that the Archdiocese became secular.
Society.
The society became.
The Catholic community.
I don't quite get the connection.
He's suggesting that after Mannix, the Catholics became rather secular. Okay. That's the suggestion. Okay, yeah, your response.
I can't see that at all. Mannix inaugurated, a new form of Catholicism, which I think was much more sensible and much more adaptable to the modern world because he understood modernity in a way that Carr didn't. If Melbourne became in any way secular, it happened 70 years later.
As someone who grew up at the time, it wasn't secular.
No.
It was focused on society and religious. I mean, it wasn't pious, it was religious. But John, we've got to be quick and then we go down there. Yeah.
When and in what circumstances did Mannix become a nationalist? Was he a nationalist before he arrived in Melbourne?
Well, this is a terrific question because I can't answer it. And I've got a quote here on it.
So the question is, in what circumstances did Mannix become a nationalist?
An Irish nationalist.
Yeah.
Now, he never said a word in Ireland about Irish nationalism. He wrote one article on landlordism, which was a problem before Home Rule, the fact that the Irish didn't own it. But it's clear that he thought very deeply in Ireland about Irish history and about the Irish nation, and this comes out in all his speeches. So he's obviously thought a lot about it. I'll just read out one quote, because there's one thing that's interesting about him. His article on landlordism is on economics. And unlike all the Australian ones who've never been to Ireland and really know nothing about Ireland, the Australian people all talk about the great island of the saints and scholars of the medieval period, Gaelic speaking. Mannix says the following on waiting for home rule. It's quoted in the book. This is quite late, about 1917 or 18. Men and women of Irish extraction are tired and weary of this waiting. During the years through which we have been waiting, Ireland has been depopulated, her harbours have been emptied, her trade has been ruined, her people have been scattered, drip by drip, her lifeblood has been ebbing away. And still these plausible people, the English government, tell us to wait and see. So he focuses there on Ireland's economic difficulties. And he's very aware of the Sinn Féin movement, which none of, because he's just come from Ireland, and all those underground currents which are going on, which none of the others have. And when the Easter Rebellion occurs, he gives the most wonderful speech fitting it into Irish history. He goes right through Irish history and he says, it's lamentable, but at every stage, because of British intransigence, we've had to go one step further. And we're finally, it's very lamentable, but we're finally had to move to physical force, because the Ulster people are, he said, to truckle with treason is never safe for any government, what the Ulster people do. He said, it's very lamentable. It was the 80s. I'm using my words. It was the only move left. So he gives an account which shows that he understands Irish history and nationalism extremely well, but he never says where he gets it from, and he never said a word about it in Ireland. So it's a mystery. He must have just read it up and had it in his brain.
There's a person on the back there. Never came up the front. Yeah, we've got to be quick. Yeah.
It was very interesting to hear what you said about Mannix rebuking his own archbishop in public. The Blim, of course, was quite on the other foot when, during World War II, the Vatican imposed Justin Simmons on him in order to keep him out of control of that war. Yeah. He treated Simmons
well. Yes, I'll talk. Now, he didn't rebuke him. He's very smart. He praised him. He said, this is your wonderful Archbishop here. They've treated him badly. They haven't listened to him. I'm a sinner in this regard. But, you know, there's a coded message underneath. Simmons, that's a wonderful thing. I did the Santa Maria papers. And Santa Maria had a file on Archbishop Simmons, a very thick file, because he's an opponent. And in that, there are three wonderful letters. I'll just mention them, on Mannix and Simmons. So Mannix doesn't come out well of this. In 1943, a priest from the Hobart Diocese, Santa Maria had priests all over Australia writing to him for 60 years on all the scams, and politicians writing to him. A priest in 1943 said, there's terrific news, Bob. Simmons has been told by a delegate that he wants to see him in Sydney, middle of the war. He has to go by boat, you can't go by plane, but he must take a boat which by no means can call in at Melbourne. He has to go straight there. And he says, the background is, Simmons is going to be appointed coadjutor. If Mannix finds out he's got the right to knock it back, it's all got to be done without him knowing. So that's the first thing. This is a Vatican move to corral, to quarantine, put something on Mannix. There's a second letter in this voluminous file which says, it's from a person in the Chancellery of Melbourne. A year later, it says, this morning, the dreaded cable arrived from the Vatican appointing Simmons. We all sat round like stunned nullets. Who was going to take this terrible document to Mannix, who was out at Raheen? We all looked round, and finally the lot fell on Laurie Moran, who was the Vicar General. Laurie Moran drove out to Raheen, but on his way out, his resolve wilted. That was the word. So wonderful. His resolve wilted, and like a coward, he gave the cable to Miss Vergona, Mannix's housekeeper, so she could see him, because no one wanted to see Mannix when he found out. This is an amazing appointment. Not only was he not told, but she had a right to knock it back. This is a full archbishop. Simmons is a full archbishop in a see, Hobart, being appointed to a coadjutor. No. And the third letter in this document was about 20 years later, another priest writes to Bob and says, when Simmons got to Melbourne, Mannix gave him an enormous church, pro-cathedral St Mary. He gave him a driver. He gave him a personal secretary. And he consulted him on no major issue in the next 20 years. Now, that's not a pro-Mannix story. That shows in Mannix some, behind the lovely Irish soft voice, there's something pretty tough there. Now, you can say that the Vatican treated him badly, but so that's the story on. That's one of the stories on Mannix and Simmons.
Now we go because we're going there, and we're going Stuart, then we're going Hillary. Yeah?
Patrick, while there's the Irish thing, there's also the Rome thing. And to what extent is really the building of the Catholic system of education the real divide? I mean, even the Labour Party tried to keep the Catholic Federation, members of the Catholic Federation, out of the Labour Party. This notion that Australia wanted to be in a sense, secular at certain official levels, and the idea that Catholics didn't owe their loyalty just to the British, but also to Rome. How much is the Rome versus English division important?
Leaving out Catholic education, it's clear in the 19th century that Catholic bishops in Australia have four sources of authority. One is Rome, one is the Irish hierarchy, who are their real bosses. They think they're bosses of the Irish hierarchy. The third source of authority is the local government in Victoria, which they don't really give us enough about much. And the fourth one is the British government, which they do. So they have to balance these four things. And it's very different from England, where there's an established church and the Catholics are very minority. Or the opposite in Ireland, where the Catholics are almost an established church. The bishops can throw their weight around. I was in Ireland in 1980. I couldn't believe the way even then the British bishops would have get up as though they were running the show. They hardly were. So they had these four sources of authority. Every time they had to put out anything, they had to juggle these four sources. And you can see it in every move they make. And when Gould makes the mistakes because he doesn't understand. So it's in every issue had to be played differently, and they looked at these four sources of authority. And there's also the view that in the 19th century Rome had an informal agreement with the Vatican and the Irish hierarchy, but if the Irish hierarchy damped down Irish nationalism, the Vatican loved this because they hated the French Revolution and they just lost the Papal States that were Sorgimento, so those thought that sort of thing. That was a sort of agreement between the three parties, and the quid pro quo was that they could, the Catholic Church could prosper in the colonies and wouldn't be stopped in the colonies. So there's a kind of deal like that going on. So they've got to take in all those things. And in the biography of Archbishop Carr, it shows that the British government had an agent in the Vatican at this stage, keeping croak type appointments off the bishops' lists in Ireland. So the Vatican and the Irish hierarchy are really against Irish nationalism because they see it as a threat. That's a very general answer to your question, but it certainly, it's in their minds what Rome and the British government think the whole time. And you can see this in their correspondence, really.
I think this may be the last question. See how we go. Stuart?
Okay. Yeah. It's clear in Great Britain what the effect of Gladstone's three Home Rule bills were. The Liberal Party split and it was kept out of power for a generation. Mm-hmm. What was the effect in Melbourne or Australia of the Home Rule bills of Gladstone specifically?
Well, in Melbourne, they basically went on the back burner for that whole period in Salisbury's Inn. So after there's three bills, I've forgotten them, but once Gladstone retires and then soon dies, the Melbourne Home Rulers just say, you know, the times are very bad. I think it's a 15-year period, all Salisbury and then Balfour, really from
1806 to 1906.
Yeah, the Tories are in for an enormous period. So the Melbourne Home Rulers just, as I say, they go on the back burner, they form another organisation. There's the Parnell disaster at the same time, which wrecks the Irish Party, splits the Irish Party. So they have a very bad period. And they only gear up again, you know, gradually before the 1908, in that sort of period later on, they start getting going again because politically, in a very bad situation. And previously, the Irish, under Parnell, they had the corner in Parliament. They had 80 members and they could almost control Parliament. They completely lost that under Salisbury. So they admit that they're in a very bad situation. And when do they revive?
1906.
I'm just trying to think. The Melbourne ones really don't get going again until the First World War, until Mannix comes. They have a long period when they're very pessimistic, basically.
You have a very quick question. Yeah.
Yes.
Very quick.
I grew up as a Catholic in Protestant Melbourne. I came to to Sydney when I was about 20, and I was just bowled over. New South Wales seemed to be ruled by the right wing of the Labour Party, which was Catholic, and the Catholic Archbishops of Sydney. This is a Catholic city, which I didn't feel about Melbourne. It's a Protestant city.
Yes, that's true. Patrick Ford shows that Moran lent on the Labour Party here for the whole of the 1890s to stop what we call the socialist left getting control. He was loved by them because of the strikes and everything, and he, therefore, there was a very strong bond between the Catholics and the Labour Party, which is now only fraying after 100 years. In Melbourne, the situation was very different for two reasons. The left faction was very powerful, but there was another faction in Melbourne, which was the 19th century small L liberals, David Syme, Deakin, Higginbotham, the Chief Justice, supported openly the Labor Party when he was Chief Justice, and so did Henry Vaughan Higgins when he was in the High Court. In the Trades Hall in Melbourne today, Higginbotham's portrait is there. So the whole Melbourne liberal establishment, they're not anti-Catholic, and many of them are people who've left religion. All these people are leaving religion in various ways, Unitarians and others. They're also a very strong influence in the Labor Party. So that becomes the dominant faction. So when Mannix tries to heavy the Labor Party in 1915 or 16, they just ban the Catholic thing because it's very different. There's a new book come out on the Labor Party, Neither Power or Glory, which actually, well, that's written by a member of the Socialist Left, explains all this very well. So the differences are very, very striking. And this new historian says, in 1917, Billy Hughes walks out, the Catholics, and in Melbourne, they were called the Catholics. So, but in 1754, Kennelly and Caldwell were called the Catholics, meaning they never had Catholic before. Here, Catholics are starting to run the show. In Sydney, you wouldn't say the Catholics. It was the same almost as the party. So there are extraordinary differences between the two cultures. Yeah. And even when I was at uni, Bill Hartley ran the Socialist Left, and Whitlam said to him, only the impotent are pure, which meant, you know, only unsuccessful groups like the Victorians who live on ideology and never want to get elected can be pure. So the same thing, there were quotes from the Advocate saying exactly the same about the party. I've got them in the book, that the Labor Party was unelectable and full of secularists, they use the phrase, unattractive to Catholicism. They're saying exactly the same about the party in 1911 as people were saying about the Victorian Labor Party in the 1960s.
Many thanks, Patrick. I'll be very brief. Patrick Morgan's made a very important contribution to Australian history, particularly in recent years with his work, but throughout his career, but particularly since he's had time to put together a number of books, important books. Most recently, Melbourne Before Mannix, significant topic, well explained, lively, interesting. We'll hope you come back again, but for tonight, well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.